And Senate Resources will come to order at 3:35. Senator Green, Senator Stevens, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Wagner, and myself, and Bert Stedman is on his way. Today, we have on the agenda Cook Inlet Natural Gas Supply and Demand. And if you answer that, now, Kevin, I know you're going to be presenting as the Acting Director of Division of Oil and Gas, DNR, but your tie and monopoly, does that have a message in it someplace?
Well, frankly, I needed to make the distinction, Mr. Chairman, between the director of BGGNet and PGS, who is a geologist. By training, I'm an economist. So
I see. I see.
I'll actually be referring to him personally.
Yeah. Well, if I might, but before we put you on record, you know, just as a point of departure, you know, we've essentially been trying to focus on Cook Inlet and where we are, where we've been, and more important, where are we going. And we had Harold Hines here the other day telling us how it was important for us to look at his proposition because we had to get gas down to Cook Inlet. And then earlier, you know, we had a look at the geological foundation that it's all laid on. I see. One of our more celebrated people here that did that for us. That, you know, who knows? And the question is, hopefully you know, what we have for supply in the basin. So with that, if you put yourself on the record.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Banks. I'm the Acting Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And today I'd like to talk to you briefly about the market indicators and the supply and demand balance in the Cook Inlet region. And my slide presentation is about a dozen slides that will go to the topic that I'm dealing with and flow with my remarks. And then the remaining set of slides I've included as an appendix. Perhaps if I can go through this fairly quickly, and as questions come up, I can refer to the other slides in the back, and also for your edification, if you wish to review this later, and by all means, I'm available to respond to questions even after this hearing. The reason we're here today, I believe, is there are concerns about price. There's concerns about whether or not the agri fertilizer plant will stay in business, and an immediate concern, or about to be an immediate concern, related to the extension of the LNG export license from beyond 2009 for 2 years, 2010 and 2011. Now, perhaps if none of these were a problem with us, you wouldn't have me here today, or you wouldn't have been talking to Bob Swenson a couple weeks ago, or Harold Hines last week. What we'll see, I think, in this presentation, that we're now in a marketplace where I think it's apt to refer to my colleague Bob Swenson's image of a funnel and a tube. I think it indicates that he spent far too much time in a fraternity house, but it does actually say something about the marketplace. That you can only force so much gas into this marketplace at any given time because it's driven by how much consumption can occur here. And the response to that demand is entirely dependent on price, but also the players that are involved in producing gas. I'll try to get to that as we talk about this issue. As you can see in slide number 3, the dark blue line, the lower line, represents what amounts to what the utilities pay for their gas, or the wholesale price of gas, or gas sold at the wellhead. It's listed as the DRPD. It represents Department of Revenue's prevailing value for gas there, and that is simply a weighted average of the price of gas paid by the electrical generation utilities and NSTAR and others in the Cook Inlet. In the last 3 or 4 years, we can see the prices have virtually doubled at the wellhead from to about $5.30 2006, about twice what it was in 2004. Largely, this is because, and I think you've heard from the RCA chairman, Kate Gerard, speak to this, it's largely due to the fact that many of the older contracts had price terms that were tied to the price of oil, but also because more newer contracts, particularly the NSTAR Unocal or Chevron now contract, which set the price to a Henry Hub marker with some conditions applied. So as prices have risen in the lower 48 for gas, that's driven up some part of the market, a weighted average price for the utility prices. It's also a response to the large increase in oil experienced in the same period of time. It actually shows also that the stimulant market is following what's going on in the lower 48 to a certain extent. And that's perhaps a good thing for us in a sense, because it's those lower 48 markets with whom we are competing for investment in new exploration, new activities here in the Cook Inlet. And I think I can demonstrate that those increased prices are correlated with new exploration and new activity in the basin. Slide number 4 will give you a breakdown of where the gas is going when it comes to one of the takeaway points from this rather complicated story a little bit about NSTAR. You can see that residential and commercial uses of gas and gas used by the electrical utilities really amounts to less than a third of the consumption of gas in the Cook Inlet. And that two-thirds of the gas is consumed by the industrial users, the LNG plant for export and the fertilizer plant. The industrial users rely on low-cost baseload supplies in order to run their businesses. They are also uniform consumers year-round. There's not a large swing in demand for their purposes. They were initially established by the owners of the gas. The LNG plant is still operated by ConocoPhillips and Marathon. And it was Unocal years ago that built the fertilizer plant before it sold it to Agrium in order to monetize their reserves, in order to get value to reserves that would otherwise have been stranded in the Cook Inlet. And until recently, these users have provided the sole means of backstopping peak demand days for the commercial and residential users of gas. In other words, if on a very cold day in the wintertime, either Agrium or more recently LNG would redirect their dispositions into the NSTAR system to supply gas for heat. And that's actually illustrated in slide number 5 to some degree. This looks like the Northern Lights, and so I apologize for that. Without going into detail of what it's really, what a heating degree day means or that, but I can at least point out to you that it does show, at least in blue, the kind of demand we see from day to day as we get through the winter to the end of the summer months. It simply says that when it's cold, consumption of gas goes up, and it's cold in the winter time. And it's the seasonal delivery, which is becoming an important issue. And it's enough to say, perhaps, that two things we can say about seasonality is that most of the contracts that the utilities have entered into in the past have incorporated full requirements or accounted for full delivery. In other words, when NSTAR has entered into its agreements in years past, the suppliers have basically promised to deliver all the gas they'll need on any given day. And that embedded in the price, usually, is that service. More recently, there's been a pricing mechanism to try to separate that peak delivery out. And who knows, I think in the future we may see a more distinct peak gas price versus a baseload price as time goes on. Slide number four speaks to the question you asked me when I sat down, and whether or not we're going to have gas in the future. Today's proved developed and producing supply of gas or reserves is about 1.6, 1.7 billion cubic, trillion cubic feet. This is consistent with remarks that you heard from Bob Swenson a couple weeks ago, and this represents, in DNR's estimate, the amount of gas that's available if you do no more investment in the existing fields. This is the kind of reserve you can pull out of these existing fields without any further drilling or additions of compression or workover on existing wells. That gives us today about a reserves to production ratio of about 8 years. In other words, we can run with that supply of gas for another 8 years at today's current consumption rates. While that is significantly lower than it was some 25 years ago, it is actually fairly consistent with the kind of reserve production ratio you see in markets in the lower 48. Yet to find gas represents undiscovered gas, the kinds of numbers that Bob Swenson was talking about. Places where gas has not yet been found in the stratigraphic plays and in new conventional gas resources that have not yet been fully explored. Missing fields, that goes to the comment that Bob Swenson talked about, and I think it's an important point to make, is that, and I'll tell you why in a moment, but that goes to the point, if you'll recall, he showed us a graph where we have several gas fields that were fairly small, very few gas fields that were very large, and typically, we should expect the distribution of gas fields on such a chart like that to be fairly continuous. But there was a large gap in that chart of gas fields between 200 to 500 billion cubic feet in size. So it suggests that there is a potential for some very large new sources of undiscovered gas that could come online given the price and given consumption. And that comes to a very important point. Going back to the analogy of the beer bong, if I may, it might be fairly easy to bring a 10 or 20, 30 BCF field online today and be able to squeeze a flow of gas out of that into the market. But if you find 200 to 500 billion cubic foot gas field, now you have a fairly lumpy supply of gas that will just sit in the funnel and not be able to flow into the hose without something changing in the marketplace to make room for it. Back to the situation where we might have been years ago when ConocoPhillips, or Phillips in those days, Marathon and Unocal in those days, had to find and invent a new use for gas in order to keep it from being stranded. So while it would be a wonderful thing to find a half a T of gas in a gas field somewhere in the Cook Inlet, it may very well be like drilling a dry hole. I'd like to talk a bit about how things work in the lower 48 in terms of our expectation in the future for how gas is usually supplied out of the onshore and OCS North American market. You can see that existing fields, the orange area in this graph, are falling off fairly dramatically over the next several years. That's similar to the graphics that we showed you, and I'll get to that point later, that we see in the Cook Inlet. So when I told you that there was about 1.6 trillion cubic feet of proved, developed, and producing gas, that's the orange part of this graph. In 2010, it represents about 40%, of just eyeballing this graph, of what will be future gas supplies in the North American market. What has to happen is a lot of investment in those existing fields to lift that line up to the next skin in that graph. Beyond that, we have to start discovering gas in new conventional fields. Just plain looking through the geology,
finding prospects and drilling them in areas where you have not drilled before. And then lastly, a portion of new gas in the lower 48 will come from non-conventional fields. This is tight gas and coal bed methane, mostly. It's, I'll point out that this is a marketplace with thousands of gas fields and tens of thousands of wells. So it's a very liquid market, lots of producers, lots of buyers. It's not a condition that we have here in the Cook Inlet. And graphic number 8 represents the Department of Natural Resources and the Oil and Gas's annual report estimate of future gas supply. And it's the cliff that we worry about, because although everything to the right of the dark black line represents about 1.6 TCF, we recognize in order to keep a steady supply, something's got to happen. First of all, we'll have to see investment in the existing fields, as was the case in the graph before it, and that would represent kind of that dotted line with the first set of question marks. Who knows where that pushes us? But that's, as I mentioned, workovers, new wells in the existing fields, more compression to draw out more gas. And at the same time, and I don't want to underestimate the problem this may cause, that we're working in an environment or in a region where drawing on gas from these new supplies or these existing fields has a potential of hitting some serious consequences of watering out the wells, of hitting other engineering challenges to make sure that this gas can be produced without shutting down the field altogether. Then above that line would be the area of new discoveries, kinds of stratigraphic trap and other unexplored activities that you heard about a couple weeks ago. And then lastly, gas has to come from unconventional sources, so perhaps coal bed methane, or perhaps a spur from the North Slope, Harold Hines's proposition, or imports of LNG to fill the gap at the very top. That's sort of the state of play in supply, and the question marks there are on purpose, because it will depend on how the market responds to the price today and whether or not in 5 to 10 years that market response will be demonstrated in new gas, because it is truly what's going on now that's important. And I can demonstrate what we've seen so far. On table 9, you see this is the results of several lease sales in the Cook Inlet since we began doing area-wide lease sales in the Cook Inlet in 1999. Now this means that we are offering every available acre of state land for oil and gas leasing each year on a fairly routine and regular basis. So companies are able to evaluate the land before they make their bids and have an opportunity to know that in a predictable way that if they miss the bid this time, they'll have another year hence to try again. You'll see that the number of tracts sold in each sales have been increasing fairly steadily, and that the bid per acre has gone up during the same time frame. The high bid in some of these sales have actually been pretty good. I think if I turn back to the appendix, there's a blown up version of this same table with a good deal more facts about how these sales work on page 16. So that in the in our last sale, although it wasn't the highest high bid ever, it was in the last 10 years, at least it was $45 an acre. I also point out, too, that in this most recent sale, about 21 tracts of the 71 that were sold received multiple bids, so that we're seeing a lot more competition for those lease sales. In the graphic on number 10, you've seen this one before, but I just love it. It really does tell you that something is happening in response to the increase in prices and in the potential for new market, a place in the market for new gas. And this says that basically since say about the year 2000. We've seen almost a doubling of drilling activity in the Cook Inlet. And furthermore, about 80% of those wells have been searching for gas instead of oil. Out of the 320-some exploration wells that are illustrated in this table or in this graphic, about 30 in the last few years have had gas as their target. Another feature that's changing in the marketplace, and this goes back to the issue of seasonality and deliverability and peak demand, is the storage issue. And this is where our lessees, our producers, have stepped up to the plate to manage deliverability in a way that they haven't in the past. With these huge gas fields like Kenai and Beluga, North Cook Inlet, where there was a lot of gas available at the by just opening the valve and adding some more compression to satisfy the peak demand in the wintertime, now we've come to the point where there's a requirement that we pull gas out of these fields year-round and store gas in the summer for use in the wintertime. There are today four storage facilities, two of which are on state land at the Kenai Gas Field and at Pretty Creek. The Swanson River is a federal is on federal land. It's actually the largest of the four, and it has a total of about 10 BCF capacity. And we'll talk about how that'll be used. There are operational challenges with this. I was just talking to Bob about this earlier. These gas fields, when you put gas into a exhausted gas field, you don't get all of the gas back that you put in. So there's a cost to pushing gas down in the ground to be used later on. And gas will either fall into solution in the oil that's already there, or in the case of places like Kenai Gas, it has the same problem of any of the Cook Inlet gas fields where watering out and other issues like that will occur.
Is there any rule of thumb,
Kevin, on what percentage you would calculate?
I don't know the answer to that, Senator. But I'll get it for
you. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I borrowed this slide on number 12 from NSTAR, thanks to Mr. Curtis Thayer. It represents the second of two slides. I'll just talk a bit about what this is saying to us. You see these two large yellow arrows, one pulling gas out of the Kenai Peninsula into the Anchorage market, and the second up there in the Beluga River area on the western side of the Cook Inlet, drawing into the Anchorage. In the last time there was a fairly serious peak day event in 1999, the amount of gas coming out of the east side was about 183 million cubic feet. It's almost it's dropped by almost a third to the 122 you see here. Similarly, on the Kenai Peninsula, in February of 1999, the amount of gas drawn off the Kenai was about 89 million cubic feet. It's almost doubled in this arrow represented by the 170 million cubic feet you see here. The other factors were is that in those days, in 1999, there was no storage. And in the green box on the lower right-hand side, it shows a storage draw of 55 million cubic feet from the Swanson River and Kenai gas fields, and storage in the upper dark green box of about 8 million cubic feet coming out of Pretty Creek. So those storage facilities are actually providing a service today, right now, and supplying gas on those peak cold days to make sure that consumers in the NSTAR system are getting the gas that they need. The other point is that a lot more gas is coming from the east side of the Cook Inlet, whereas in the mid-90s and through the late 90s, more gas was coming out of the west side. I believe that NSTAR is making investments this summer to make sure that the plumbing, so to speak, on the west side will facilitate that kind of movement of that kind of production and gas movements into the Anchorage area. The other two blue arrows, I think, are worth noting,
Kevin,
too.
Kevin, excuse me one mm-hmm. second. The Pretty Creek, is that Pretty Creek that's on Beluga River, or is it?
I believe that's correct.
It's on Kena.
No, it's on the west side.
It's on the west side.
Okay, so it's right there at the mouth of Beluga River inland. Yeah, okay. Good fishing spot, too.
Won't be. All hands will fish it out.
The other thing to point out is that 53 million cubic feet of gas was drawn out of the KKPL gas pipeline. That really represents the consequence of new developments on the east side of the Cook Inlet. And I think it's an important point to note that we are seeing production from places that hadn't been producing before. And then finally, about 35 million cubic feet of gas was diverted, if you will, from the LNG plant during this event on January 9th, from the LNG plant into the local market. So that's the backstop feature that I referred to earlier in describing the importance of having industrial users on the system. And that basically concludes my remarks for the moment. I have no real good predictions for you, but I could come back to the point I started with. The concerns are now about higher prices. I think that's going to be a fact of life because we are competing for investments here in the Cook Inlet where investments would otherwise stay in the lower 48 where prices are high. So we have a somewhat indirect connection to higher gas prices in the lower 48. The Agrium plant, which is now shut down for the winter, is going to be seen. I think I illustrated about 40 BCF of gas a year was being used by the plant. It's our estimate that next year it'll be down to 30 because of the wintertime shutdown. And so demand is falling off a little bit because of the industrial use is falling off. And the unavailability, basically, of a baseload supply for Agrium at an economical price for them. And hence their Blue Sky project where they will try to develop coal gas as an alternative. And lastly, we are now faced with the question before us and how to respond to ConocoPhillips and Marathon's application to extend the export license through 2011. That's where we are today, and those are the problems we're going to be working with in the next several months.
Questions for Kevin?
Yeah,
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Slide number six. Slide number six. Proved develop and producing ratio started at 21 back in 1980, and as it rolls forward every decade to 17 to 10 to 8. And as an economist, when you look at that, what point does that number get small enough to really stimulate exploration and development versus at what point is it not really of an interest to a company to continue to explore and book more proven reserves when there's no market?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think I can answer that by comparing the table on 6 with the graphic on page 10, the number of wells that have been drilled. And sometime in 1995, we start seeing this growth in gas well exploration. So it suggests that when the market started falling off of somewhere north of 10 years of an RP of 10 years, that the producers began searching for more gas. And then even more lately, we see the effect of prices going up in a similar fashion. That was the second on page 3, where prices started going up fairly dramatically in the last 3 or 4 years. So the answer to your question is that it looks like people want to start doing something in a hurry, just somewhere north of 10, an RP of 10 years.
Do you, with the implementation of PPT, do you feel that it's going to stimulate that more exploration in Cook Inlet, or retard it, or make no difference? Or PPT meaning the access to credits and other things.
I think access to credits will be very important in the Cook Inlet. There's already several incentives that have been offered to the producers there.
Mr. Chairman, there are other drilling incentives offered for drilling and exploration in Cook Inlet other than the PPT. And that's what Marathon is into, is taking advantage of a lot of that with their own rig.
And the fact that Senator Stedman, through the chair, the fact that we have a PPT that allows for, you know, deducting expenses, strikes me that in a field like the North Cook Inlet or other existing fields where you're going to want to see investment made, which is not necessarily exploration investment, at least being able to deduct that from your PPT payment, it will be valuable for the existing players there.
Just one more follow-up on, I guess from this side of the table, it's kind of a challenge to, you know, do we look for a bullet line to feed Cook Inlet? Do we look for LNG into the future to fill it? Or is there actually enough gas out there for the industry to either find, or maybe they even know about some gas that we don't? And the other two issues, the bullet line or the LNG, is a red herring. I don't know the answer to that question.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, if I were an explorationist right now, I would be trying to figure out how much those alternatives would cost consumers and what my competition is going to charge for gas before I would begin thinking about and use that basically as an estimate of my own economics. And I think there's one thing you can say about exploration in the Cook Inlet is that it certainly is fraught with a lot less a headache than the other two alternatives right off the top. They certainly are expensive alternatives as well, and so that I believe we have some cushion between what we see as today's prices in the Cook Inlet and what the cost of those sources of gas would be. And so that if I can deliver gas for what I think it's going to, for less than what I think a bullet line would deliver gas to the Cook Inlet, I would go out and start searching for gas in the Cook Inlet to compete with it.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. If I'm understanding you correct, and I'm looking at page 6 also, it says there's 1.8 TCF of undiscovered gas. And is the correct analysis in your mind, how much would it cost to find that 1.8 TCF and bring that to market versus how much would it cost to build a bullet line, say, or not a bullet line, well, I guess a bullet line, or to build a spur line off of Glen Allen? Is that kind of the analysis that you would advocate?
That's right. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it has to do with not just the an expectation of price, but also the probability that the price will be yielded. So obviously every explorationist is looking at what are the odds of finding gas, obviously, and that seems to be in the purview of most oil and gas exploration companies. They do that all the time. But you also have to factor in what are the probabilities of the alternatives. And that's a much more difficult thing to figure out.
Yeah, well, if I could follow up, then do we know what the rough estimates are to drill and to explore and to find 1.8 TCF versus what the costs are for that spur line, say, from Glen Allen? Do you have have you identified what the costs are for that?
Through the chair, no, I haven't done that ourselves at DNR, and I don't have the answer to that question for you today.
Kevin, as I recall, there's been about 220-some holes board in the ground looking for gas or oil in Cook County. Is that about right?
320 centers.
320?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. But in comparison to like-size areas that there's been discoveries in Lower 48, it's a pretty small number. Should we, as a state, have some strategy that gets us to, if we think, as Bob tells us, that it's out there, all we got to do is drill for it, and we got to figure out how to get somebody to drill for it, assuming we're not satisfied with the activity level. Should we have a strategy that gets us to a larger number of holes? And before you answer that, as I recall, last year the administration, one of the things that was thrown out in Cook Inlet was to look at putting some incentives on the table. I think that's right, Tom, from the Murkowski administration. And there, I don't think it ever went any place, but that was one of the things that was on the table for discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's possibly a need for more incentives for exploration activities. There's also a lot of information about the Cook Inlet that would be a wonderful thing if more explorationists could have a handle on that. I'm not exactly sure what the state can do in encouraging commercial arrangements among those incumbents that have that data and those newcomers that need the data. But that would be an area that I would like to examine myself to see if there isn't some way to leverage more data into the hands of those who are eager to spend some money to find gas.
Right. So you're going to start working on that between moving from acting director to director? Is that one of your goals?
That would be one of my goals, yes.
Yeah. Storage. I mean, obviously storage has some merit based on what you talked about, surge and demand in peak time frames. Storage as it exists today, is it just an initiative by the industry, or do we have a strategy that has a cause and effect on volume of storage available?
Mr. Chairman, I think storage is actually an alternative that the industry, the producers mostly, have entertained because it offers an alternative to more risky investments in their own existing fields to improve deliverability. And so given a choice of expanding the deliverability out of the existing fields or storing gas as an alternative, storage becomes the cheaper alternative for them. And so it's a natural consequence of the marketplace making that decision possible. The storage issue is somewhat exciting because in every other market in the Lower 48, storage has a very important function, and it exists at both ends of the market, so to speak. There's storage near producing and in areas in the producing region, salt domes, for example, in the south, and there's storage that's made available in the at the marketplace for those peak demand days and when the pipelines can't deliver gas into the marketplace. So storage here actually has a function in that similar way that perhaps in the future, if there's a spur line or a bullet line, that this storage would actually facilitate the economical use of that infrastructure, should it ever be built. The LNG imports and LNG export facility now plays a similar function, and it's conceivable that if some alternative future should have an LNG import reality to it, we would see that liquefied natural gas stored in the Nikiski tanks there would also provide storage for peak day use in the Cook Inlet.
Yep. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. Do you have figures on the amount of revenues that come to the state from Agrium and from the LNG plant? And also, do you have the figures on what is the price that is paid for natural gas by Agrium and by LNG versus what is paid by the consumers of South Central?
Through the chair, Senator Walkowski, yes, we do have that kind of information. I might punt to Will Nebeski, who is in Anchorage, and he may have that data on hand to be able to respond to the question, if I may.
Yeah, I'd be interested in getting that.
Can you answer that question, Will?
Yes, Kevin. I'm standing by, and actually, if you would get at least a picture of the price that the state realizes from industrial.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Could you put yourself on the record, please?
Through the chair, this is Will Nebeski. I'm a commercial analyst with the Division of Oil and Gas.
Okay, go ahead, Will.
Yes, thank you. Again, through the chair, for example, if you turn all the way to slide 35 in the packet in the appendix, this slide just illustrates the proceeds that the fertilizer plant realizes from the sale of its product into its market. That's shown on the green line. Now, at an earlier era, our royalty value was sort of tied to those fertilizer prices, actually. Today, that's changed with Agrium's acquisition of the fertilizer plant in the year 2000, but we can certainly tabulate the revenues that we receive from royalty dispositions of gas to the fertilizer plant. They do tend to be today at the lower end of the royalty revenue spectrum from the standpoint of proceeds per unit of royalty gas disposition. And there's another slide that I think is also in the slide pack that...
That's on page 33, Will.
Thank you, Kevin. This slide, through the chair, illustrates the values received for LNG dispositions in Japan and compares them with the Henry Hub spot price, as well as the Department of Revenue's published prevailing value that's shown in blue. Now, that brown line that you observe in the chart shows the destination value that is received for LNG dispositions. It's not the same as our royalty value. Our royalty proceeds in an important way are tied to that destination value, but we have different settlement agreements with Marathon as well as with ConocoPhillips regarding the royalty proceeds tied to their dispositions that end up being LNG exports. But in general, I can say this. The blue line that represents the Department of Revenue's prevailing value that Kevin illustrated early on in the in his presentation is very close to the weighted average royalty value that the state receives for its combined royalty proceeds from all the dispositions, both industrial and non-industrial. But again, we can and would be happy to tabulate the proceeds received from various industrial dispositions versus those non-industrial, if that would be helpful.
I think it would. Just one follow-up. How does the price that consumers are paying in South Central compare to what the LNG and the Agrium fertilizer plant are paying in terms of the natural gas price? How does that price compare? Are South Central consumers paying more or less, the same?
Through the chair, Kevin, I'll try this and feel free to chime in, but basically, consumers are paying currently in the neighborhood of about $6 per MCF for gas through the NSTAR system used in space heating. And that actually compares pretty closely with the Department of Revenue's prevailing value estimate as well. So those values probably are in the neighborhood of, for example, the royalty value that the state receives for LNG disposition. That does vary from time period to time period, but today, currently, I would suggest that the weighted average cost of gas in the NSTAR system is actually pretty closely matched with a netback value or royalty value estimate for LNG disposition.
I could just follow up. I guess I'm not really asking what the net back. What I'm asking for is what is the price that Conoco pays when they buy LNG? How does that compare to what consumers pay at NSTAR?
If I may try this, Mr. Chairman, Senator Volkowski, what we know about the activities of the LNG plant is basically what is the wholesale price of natural gas, I think, if I may restate your question, when it's produced by Marathon and by ConocoPhillips that is destined for LNG and eventually to be changed into LNG and then eventually sent to Japan. The answer to the question is a bit difficult to say because the value that we receive for royalty is determined by a royalty settlement agreement that's years and years old in each case. And it was intended to reflect some measure of the value of gas when sold in Japan minus the cost of getting it there, transforming it into LNG, and netted back to the wellhead. For example, ConocoPhillips is North Cook Inlet gas is valued at about a half of the price they receive for per MCF for gas sold in Japan minus 10 cents. That's just the formula for calculating that. So it represents at the moment the best indicator we have for what LNG, the netback price of LNG is to that is eventually sent to Japan. And as we heard Will Nebeski tell us, that is roughly today about what the consumers in the wholesale price for gas sold to NSTAR into the electrical utilities. Agrium is paying less than what consumers are paying for gas on average. And so that is the reason why they can exist. They are looking for a baseload supply that doesn't have a peak demand element to it, and that can be that they can purchase at an economical price. And evidently it's the acquisition of gas at an economical price which is a problem for Agrium, and hence they're shutting down in the wintertime this year.
Thank you.
Other questions for Kevin? Methane. We got to introduce that in Mat-Su here a few years back and had a bad experience. What do you see methane in Alaska as being having a place in the market?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it has several places for us. I mean, it represents a very widespread source of gas throughout rural Alaska, because coal and coal bed methane associated with it can be found in an awful lot of places. So we see an exploration license, for example, at the Red Dog Mine to possibly develop this resource, as well the potential for developing the resource in Healy, which is now on hold. In the Mat-Su Valley, as you pointed out, folks had, I think, unanticipated result of trying to develop a resource in what amounts to an Alaskan version of a residential area, frankly. And I think the possibility for developing coal bed methane in the Mat-Su Valley certainly could have been achieved had it been, had the residents of the Matsu Valley been more receptive to it. I think that's fair to say. There are certainly other areas in the Cook Inlet that may be a possible source of coal bed methane, but it's clear that the most inexpensive sources of coal bed methane and possibly the best sources of coal bed methane were to be found near the road system in Matsu. And that may be, it may be a long time before we can go back there and try again.
Harold Hines comes in and tells us spur line important and describes how he would approach that. NSTAR will tell us that they have to have a continuous supply of gas. If you look at the LNG proposition, the regulatory people say there's always a spike in known reserves when there's an application for LNG. You're our professional organization that is looking at things from a professional standpoint that we can get information from. Based on the task as you see it as the acting director, I assume to be the director here shortly, what should we, what direction should we be pointing you in and your people and your sizable staff to ensure that we in fact know what our destiny is when it comes to natural gas?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's several things that we can do. When I demonstrated that or showed you that graphic that had a sharp fall off in gas, that what we need to do is move gas from from reserves in existing fields into that proved, developed, and producing category. And we need to find new gas in the Cook Inlet. The marketplace is also at a point where it's in this very tightened balance. We've seen that in terms of the reserve to production ratios falling to 8 or 10 years that we see today. And the point is that the market will respond to a growth in demand and the and to rising prices as the supply tightens. The question is for us is to make sure that there is land available, access is available to land to when pursuing plans of development, plans of exploration with our lessees as we move forward and unitize these prospects, that we get good solid commitments from our lessees to complete the work that they say they would like to do in these areas. We formed three units in January. The development or the exploration of a couple of those will require a jackup rig. And I would certainly hope that these lessees will cooperate and bring in the equipment they need to start drilling these prospects and do so very soon. And if they fail to do that, we'll find explorers that will. I think we see PPT. We haven't seen how that has played out yet since it's brand new. As Senator Wagner has pointed out, Marathon is responding to the exploration credits that are being offered. There are several existing fields that are known deposits of gas that have not yet been developed that received a 5% royalty provision several years ago. And some of those resources are now coming online as a result of that. We know those incentives work. And it seems to me that we need to continue exploring the efficacy of those kinds of credits and tax benefits.
And
to go a little step further, what Kevin said, when I talk about Marathon, what they were doing with exploration of the credits, that was a different credit that was in the PPT. Those are drilling credits that we offered, I think, in 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there are a different one. We want to look at that. Maybe we'll get somebody to talk about those.
What's the life of those credits? Was that just a
Was there a sunset on when those were available?
I don't remember. I think there was 8 years or something like that. Michael, do you know?
I moved out to PDT in 2016.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Say that again.
About another 9-10 years.
Okay. If you look at this graph and the activity that you alluded to since the year 2000, if you look out from 2005 to 2015, what are you predicting based on the economic circumstances in Cook Inlet?
I'll predict a lot more exploration. There will be more gas wells drilled for new prospects in the next several years in response to these higher prices.
So we're going to break 330 holes, 340 holes? What do you reckon?
I think it would be, we're seeing about 10 wells a year. Sorry, let me go find that graph. Seen about 8 or 9 wells drilled a year, and I think that's certainly achievable, although we see a sort of drop down those last couple of years in 04 and 05. I think we'll see that tick up again as more activity occurs. We have new players in the Cook Inlet who are very, very active and very interested in putting together a land position to go ahead and begin drilling. Right now, Forest has just acquired a unit in the Corsair unit. We approved their application recently. I understand clearly that Forest's position as the operator there may be in question as they are shifting assets, but let's hope that if they do sell that they find a customer who's going to be eager to use that land and continue. They will have to meet the commitments they made to us to develop the Corsair, explore the Corsair unit. Similarly, there is Escapeta in the Kitchens unit next door, and both of those units will require the use of a jackup rig to drill. Once the jackup rig comes here, I think if it's sized right and it's the equipment that others can use, it may be here for a while, facilitating drilling throughout the Cook Inlet Basin.
One other follow-up, and Senator Wilkowski. The blue whale and its status, is it going to have any impact on activity that you just talked about?
Mr. Chairman, it could very well. We've already had some tracks have been deferred in the region because of those kinds of sensitivities. And there is the potential of the consequences of listing the beluga whale in the Cook Inlet could have an impact on what areas will be open to oil and gas activities in the future. I think it certainly is going to be an issue for us.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Other than Agrium and LNG and the residential residential electric power usage, are there other areas, other uses which we need to be putting more effort in finding other is there another demand out there, I guess, that we should be looking at? Or is our gas essentially stranded in Cook Inlet?
Well, Mr. Chairman, through the Senator Wilkowski, through the chairman, I would stranded used to be an issue that is, I think, a more serious problem than it is now. We're now seeing that market change so that as a result, you don't see RP ratios of 20 years anymore, and we're down to something more like what you'd expect to see in the lower 48. And as I pointed out, though, at the beginning, if someone were to find a half a T of gas, then something would have to happen in terms of expanding demand to draw that gas out. There's room in the Agrium plant. As right now, it's running at a very low capacity, half capacity basically when it's running, and so we should be able to see some increase there right off the top to as much as 50, perhaps 55 BCF a year. There's some potential growth in the LNG. But access to the LNG, of course, is limited by the owners of the LNG plant. Is there something else we can do? Years ago, there was talk of iron ore reduction, but that all of that kind of demand requires a fairly cheap price for gas. And so now we're stuck in the problem. Who's going to look for a half a T of gas in the Cook Inlet if the price is only going to be $2? It is a chicken and the egg problem. Yes, sir.
If you would look at that and just talk to us very quickly on this that we've received, 2006, and there's two categories. Number one, the blue, which is bid received, and the others are tracts deferred from sale. What and what message does this activity have any coherency that we should be able to determine a message about why people are doing what they are with bids?
We should be concerned. I think that I think there were only about four tracts deferred in that sale. I can't recall up there in the northern end. Let me see if I can lay my hands on that map. Bear with me. Is there a page number on that,
15. Mr. Chairman? It's right after 14.
Thank you. Mine's not numbered.
Very good. Yeah, not numbered, but it's after 14. The tracts that were deferred, I think, were deferred because of whales. And fortunately, as I said, there are only four there. But if more of those tracts are deferred because of whales or for habitat for other animals, then that means there's less acreage available for drilling. I think it's important, as was pointed out by Bob Swenson a couple weeks ago, is that in the one area where you can move eastward from the shoreline along the Sterling Highway, you see a fair amount of activity in terms of tracts receiving bids along the Sterling Highway. That should be an indicator that in the wildlife refuge, there's some potential for gas development there and gas exploration. So we should have a conversation with our federal landowners as to whether or not that region could be made available for gas exploration.
And is DNR working on that?
Yes, we are, sir.
Are you optimistic?
We will. Believe me, the conversation is just beginning at the moment.
Well, if we can gill net at the mouth of, or up Kenai River, we ought to be able to look for gas in some of there. Sounds to me like...
Different animal. Different animal.
We'll not get into that. Okay. Other questions for Kevin?
Mr. Chairman. Yep,
Senator Wagner.
To that point, though, just so you understand, it's my understanding now that Swanson River can be used for gas storage, but just the process just to get that field opened up and to be used for gas storage was just horrendous, several-year process. So that just tells you how hard it is, difficult it is to work with Kenai Wildlife. Just
that was because of environmental impact?
No
doubt. Assessments?
Sure. Yes.
Well, I'm not sure environmental impact assessment because there's no environment. I mean, we're using existing structures and existing wells. And
right.
It's just a real major problem to get access to anything out there. That's why you don't see much other than along the highway, because that is not along the highway is not in the refuge.
That is correct, sir.
That.
Yeah. So. One more question for you on storage, and unless there are other questions, we will terminate. When we were listening to the regulatory people pitch and the activity where which you showed the peak activities October, January, February mm-hmm. demand. There was a description, or maybe it was when we were talking during a break, but all the phone activity, all those things it took to keep gas in the system for NSTAR. The question is whether or not we should be concerned about additional storage capacity to, you know, as a safeguard, or whether you feel, based on activity, that we do not have to worry about in the immediate future additional storage capacity.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think more storage will be needed, or we make better use of the storage that we have. The Swanson River field has a much larger capacity than is certainly has been filled to date. Probably five times more gas could be pushed in there and still be still be within the lease requirements there. And perhaps storage is capable, you could fill it up with a half a tea of gas, I imagine, there if need be. As I pointed out, there are operational challenges in places like the Kenai, the Swanson River field, as with other places. Gas that's put into storage has got gas, some of that gas won't come back out again. So there'll be, there's some concern about that. I think at the moment, the market and the facilities in the Cook Inlet are just at a very crucial balance. There's enough transmission lines, there's enough barely enough interconnects to manage an event like we saw in January, and storage available. In the very near future, I would say within 3 to 4 years, a lot of that's got to change. NSTAR is going to be upgrading their interconnects there in the region around Nikiski, Soldotna, Kenai. There'll be more storage, I believe, come online, and I hope more deliverability out of the existing fields as a consequence of meeting the requirements for deliverability.
One alibi question. As I see it, 36% in 2005 was used for LNG. And one of the rationales I've heard from LNG kinds of people is that during those peak demand periods, that is a reserve that can be kicked in to make NSTAR work. Is that a good rational consideration from your point as our professional?
I agree with that statement, Mr. Chairman. They are able to divert gas that would normally be consumed by the plant on those days into the NSTAR system. So it's a matter of and do so without a substantial consequence to the capabilities of the LNG to supply their contracts. It's on those peak days that they provide that backstop, which I think is an important service that we can count on from them.
Okay. Other Senator Whitman.
Well, I was just going to say, but we should hear, if you're really interested in pursuing that line, you should hear from the people who run the plant, because I believe I've been told that several times now they have shipped ships of LNG less than a full capacity to their market. So, you know, every problem that's solved creates another problem for somebody else. Mm-hmm. So.
Kevin, I got a note here for me to remind you that the conversation you're having over the refuge is an access to additional lands mm-hmm. and drilling sites that keep us in the information loop. I think it's important for us. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worthy, if we're not looking at a strategy for where we go in the future for Cook Inlet, you know, we need to get some of your professionals thinking about that at a minimum, because quite frankly, this huge question mark, at least in my mind, about what really is the answer in Cook Inlet for the future. We got half the population of the state semi-dependent upon what the answer to that question is. Then you know, we can't idly be sitting by and speculating unless we have a plan of action that'll take away some of that huge question mark, in my estimation. So, with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.